Watch the eggs. Put the ice cream in a freezer bag. 1,000 people pass me every day, but no one ever sees me. I like it, Grandma. It's totally unthreatening. It's how I want to spend my life. And so they listen sadly, loving him all the more, their faces pressed against the sleek trim line, the white princess in the bedroom, the plain brown rotary in Granddad's paneled basement hideaway. The old gentleman runs a hand through his thatch of white hair. The woman holds her folded specs against her face. Clouds race across the westering moon. The seasons change in somber montage, going deeper into winter stillness, a landscape of silence and ice. Your doctor knows the symbols. Chapter 37. The long walk started at noon. I didn't know it would turn into a long walk. I thought it would be a miscellaneous meditation, Murray and Jack, half an hour's campus meander. But it became a major afternoon, a serious, looping, Socratic walk, with practical consequences. I met Murray after his car crash seminar, and we wandered along the fringes of the campus, past the cedar-shingled condominiums set in the trees in their familiar defensive posture, a cluster of dwellings blending so well with the environment that birds kept flying into the plate-glass windows. "You're smoking a pipe," I said. Murray smiled sneakily. "It looks good. I like it. It works." He lowered his eyes, smiling. The pipe had a long, narrow stem and cubical bowl. It was pale brown and resembled a highly disciplined household implement, perhaps an Amish or Shaker antique. I wondered if he'd chosen it to match his somewhat severe chin whiskers. A tradition of stern virtue seemed to hover about his gestures and expressions. "Why can't we be intelligent about death?" I said. "It's obvious." "It is." "Ivan Ilyich screamed for 3 days. That's about as intelligent as we get. Tolstoy himself struggled to understand. He feared it terribly." "It's almost as though our fear is what brings it on. If we could learn not to be afraid, we could live forever." "We talk ourselves into it, is that what you mean?" "I don't know what I mean. I only know I'm just going through the motions of living. I'm technically dead. My body is growing a nebulous mass. They track these things like satellites. All this as a result of a byproduct of insecticide. There's something artificial about my death. It's shallow, unfulfilling. I don't belong to the earth or sky. They ought to carve an aerosol can on my tombstone."
"Well said."
What did he mean, "well said"? I wanted him to argue with me, raise my dying to a higher level, make me feel better.
"Do you think it's unfair?" he said.
"Of course I do." "Or is that a trite answer?" He seemed to shrug. "Look how I've lived. Has my life been a mad dash for pleasure? Have I been hell-bent on self-destruction, using illegal drugs, driving fast cars, drinking to excess? A little dry sherry at faculty parties. I eat bland foods."
"No, you don't."
He puffed seriously on his pipe, his cheeks going hollow. We walked in silence for a while.
"Do you think your death is premature?" he said.
"Every death is premature. There's no scientific reason why we can't live 150 years. Some people actually do it, according to a headline I saw at the supermarket."
"Do you think it's a sense of incompleteness that causes you the deepest regret? There are things you still hope to accomplish, work to be done, intellectual challenges to be faced?"
"The deepest regret is death. The only thing to face is death. This is all I think about. There's only one issue here. I want to live."
From the Robert Wise film of the same name, with Susan Hayward as Barbara Graham, a convicted murderess, aggressive jazz score by Johnny Mandel. I looked at him. So, you're saying, Jack, that death would be just as threatening even if you'd accomplished all you'd ever hoped to accomplish in your life and work? Are you crazy? Of course. That's an elitist idea. Would you ask a man who bags groceries if he fears death not because it is death, but because there are still some interesting groceries he would like to bag?
Well said.
This is death. I don't want it to tarry a while so I can write a monograph. I want it to go away for 70 or 80 years. Your status as a doomed man lends your words a certain prestige and authority. I like that. As the time nears, I think you'll find that people will be eager to hear what you have to say. They will seek you out. Are you saying this is a wonderful opportunity for me to win friends? I'm saying you can't let down the living by slipping into self-pity and despair. People will depend on you to be brave. What people look for in a dying friend is a stubborn kind of gravel-voiced nobility, a refusal to give in, with moments of indomitable humor. You're growing in prestige even as we speak. You're creating a hazy light about your own body. I have to like it. We walked down the middle of a steep and winding street. There was no one around. The houses here were old and looming, set above narrow stone stairways in partial disrepair. Do you believe love is stronger than death? Not in a million years. Good, he said. Nothing is stronger than death. Do you believe the only people who fear death are those who are afraid of life? That's crazy. Completely stupid. Right. We all fear death to some extent. Those who claim otherwise are lying to themselves. Shallow people. People with their nicknames on their license plates. Excellent, Jack. Do you believe life without death is somehow incomplete? How could it be incomplete? Death is what makes it incomplete. Doesn't our knowledge of death make life more precious? What good is a preciousness based on fear and anxiety? It's an anxious, quivering thing. True. The most deeply precious things are those we feel secure about. A wife, a child. Does the specter of death make a child more precious? No. No. There is no reason to believe life is more precious because it is fleeting. Here is a statement. A person has to be told he is going to die before he can begin to live life to the fullest. True or false? False. Once your death is established, it becomes impossible to live a satisfying life. Would you prefer to know the exact date and time of your death? Absolutely not. It's bad enough to fear the unknown. Faced with the unknown, we can pretend it isn't there. Exact dates would drive many to suicide, if only to beat the system. We crossed an old highway bridge, screened in, littered with sad and faded objects. We followed a footpath along a creek, approached the edge of the high school playing field. Women brought small children here to play in the long jump pits. How do I get around it? I said. You could put your faith in technology. It got you here. It can get you out. This is the whole point of technology. It creates an appetite for immortality on the one hand. It threatens universal extinction on the other. Technology is lust removed from nature.
It is.
It's what we invented to conceal the terrible secret of our decaying bodies. But it's also life, isn't it? It prolongs life. It provides new organs for those that wear out. New devices, new techniques every day. Lasers, masers, ultrasound. Give yourself up to it, Jack. Believe in it. They'll insert you in a gleaming tube, irradiate your body with the basic stuff of the universe. Light. Energy, dreams, God's own goodness.
I don't think I want to see any doctors for a while, Murray, thanks.
In that case, you can always get around death by concentrating on the life beyond.
How do I do that?
It's obvious. Read up on reincarnation, transmigration, hyperspace, the resurrection of the dead, and so on. Some gorgeous systems have evolved from these beliefs. Study them.
Do you believe in any of these things?
Millions of people have believed for thousands of years. Throw in with them. Belief in a second birth, a second life, is practically universal. This must mean something.
But these gorgeous systems are also different.
Pick one you like.
But you make it sound like a convenient fantasy, the worst kind of self-delusion.
Again he seemed to shrug. Think of the great poetry, the music and dance and ritual that spring forth from our aspiring to a life beyond death. Maybe these things are justification enough for our hopes and dreams, although I wouldn't say that to a dying man.
He poked me with an elbow. We walked toward the commercial part of town. Murray paused, raised one foot behind him, reached back to knock some ashes from his pipe. Then he pocketed the thing expertly, inserting it bowl first in his corduroy jacket.
Seriously, you can find a great deal of long-range solace in the idea of an afterlife.
But don't I have to believe? Don't I have to feel in my heart that there is something, genuinely, beyond this life, out there, looming in the dark?
What do you think the afterlife is? A body of facts just waiting to be uncovered? Do you think the U.S. Air Force is secretly gathering data on the afterlife and keeping it under wraps because we're not mature enough to accept the findings? The findings would cause panic?
No. I'll tell you what the afterlife is. It's a sweet and terribly touching idea. You can take it or leave it. In the meantime, what you have to do is survive an assassination attempt. That would be an instant tonic. You would feel specially favored. You would grow in charisma.
You said earlier that death was making me grow in charisma.
Besides, who would want to kill me?
Once more he shrugged. Survive a train wreck in which 100 die. Get thrown clear when your single-engine Cessna crashes on a golf course after striking a power line in heavy rain just minutes after takeoff.
It doesn't have to be assassination.
The point is, you're standing at the edge of a smoldering ruin where others lie inert and twisted. This can counteract the effect of any number of nebulous masses, at least for a time.
We window-shopped a while, then went into a shoe store. Murray looked at Ouijans, wallabies, hush puppies. We wandered out into the sun. Children in strollers squinted up at us, appearing to think we were something strange.
Has your German helped?
I can't say it has.
Has it ever helped?
I can't say. I don't know.
Who knows these things?
What have you been trying to do all these years?
Put myself under a spell, I guess.
Correct. Nothing to be ashamed of, Jack. It's only your fear that makes you act this way.
Only my fear? Only my death?
We shouldn't be surprised at your lack of success. How powerful did the Germans prove to be? They lost the war, after all.
That's what Denise said.
You've discussed this with the children?
Superficially.
Helpless and fearful people are drawn to magical figures, mythic figures, epic men who intimidate and darkly loom.
You're talking about Hitler, I take it.
Some people are larger than life. Hitler is larger than death. You thought he would protect you.
I understand completely.
Do you?
Because I wish I did.
Oh, it's totally obvious. You wanted to be helped and sheltered. The overwhelming horror would leave no room for your own death. Submerge me, you said. Absorb my fear. On one level, you wanted to conceal yourself in Hitler and his works. On another level, you wanted to use him to grow in significance and strength.
I sense a confusion of means.
Oh, not that I'm criticizing.
It was a daring thing you did, a daring thrust. To use him. I can admire the attempt even as I see how totally dumb it was, although no dumber than wearing a charm or knocking wood. 600 million Hindus stay home from work if the signs are not favorable that morning. So I'm not singling you out.
The vast and terrible depth.
Of course, he said.
The inexhaustibility. I understand. The whole huge, nameless thing.
Yes, absolutely.
The massive darkness.
Certainly, certainly.
The whole terrible, endless hugeness. I know exactly what you mean.
He tapped the fender of a diagonally parked car, half smiling.
Why have you failed, Jack?
A confusion of means.
Correct. There are numerous ways to get around death. You tried to employ two of them at once. You stood out on the one hand and tried to hide on the other. What is the name we give to this attempt?
Dumb.
I followed him into the supermarket. Blasts of color, layers of oceanic sound. We walked under a bright banner announcing a raffle to raise money for some incurable disease. The wording seemed to indicate that the winner would get the disease. Murray likened the banner to a Tibetan prayer flag.
Why have I had this fear so long, so consistently?
It's obvious. You don't know how to repress. We're all aware there's no escape from death. How do we deal with this crushing knowledge? We repress, we disguise, we bury, we exclude. Some people do it better than others, that's all.
How can I improve?
You can't. Some people just don't have the unconscious tools to perform the necessary disguising operations.
How do we know repression exists if the tools are unconscious and the thing we're repressing is so cleverly disguised?
Freud said so. Speaking of looming figures.
He picked up a box of Handy Wrap 2, reading the display type, studying the colors. He smelled a packet of dehydrated soup. The data was strong today.
Do you think I'm somehow healthier because I don't know how to repress? Is it possible that constant fear is the natural state of man, and that by living close to my fear I am actually doing something heroic, Murray?
Do you feel heroic?
No.
Then you probably aren't.
But isn't repression unnatural?
Fear is unnatural.
Lightning and thunder are unnatural. Pain, death, reality, these are all unnatural. We can't bear these things as they are. We know too much. So we resort to repression, compromise, and disguise. This is how we survive in the universe. This is the natural language of the species.
I looked at him carefully.
I exercise. I take care of my body.
No, you don't, he said.
He helped an old man read the date on a loaf of raisin bread. Children sailed by in silver carts.
Tegrin, Denerex, Selsun Blue.
Murray wrote something in his little book. I watched him step deftly around a dozen fallen eggs oozing yolky matter from a busted carton.
Why do I feel so good when I'm with Wilder?
It's not like being with the other kids, I said.
You sense his total ego, his freedom from limits.
In what way is he free from limits?
He doesn't know he's going to die. He doesn't know death at all.
You cherish this simpleton blessing of his, this exemption from harm. You want to get close to him, touch him, look at him, breathe him in. How lucky he is! A cloud of unknowing, an omnipotent little person. The child is everything. The adult, nothing.
Think about it.
A person's entire life is the unraveling of this conflict. No wonder we are bewildered, staggered, shattered.
Aren't you going too far?
I'm from New York.
We create beautiful and lasting things, build vast civilizations. Gorgeous evasions, he said. Great escapes. The doors parted photoelectronically. We went outside, walking past the dry cleaner, the hairstylist, the optician. Murray relighted his pipe, sucking impressively at the mouthpiece. We have talked about ways to get around death, he said. We have discussed how you've already tried two such ways, each canceling the other. We have mentioned technology, train wrecks, belief in an afterlife. There are other methods as well, and I would like to talk about one such approach. We crossed the street. I believe, Jack, there are two kinds of people in the world, killers and dyers. Most of us are dyers. We don't have the disposition, the rage, or whatever it takes to be a killer. We let death happen. We lie down and die. But think what it's like to be a killer. Think how exciting it is, in theory, to kill a person in direct confrontation. If he dies, you cannot. To kill him is to gain life credit. The more people you kill, the more credit you store up. It explains any number of massacres, wars, executions. Are you saying that men have tried throughout history to cure themselves of death by killing others? It's obvious. And you call this exciting? I'm talking theory. In theory, violence is a form of rebirth. The dyer passively succumbs. The killer lives on. What a marvelous equation! As a marauding band amasses dead bodies, it gathers strength. Strength accumulates like a favor from the gods. What does this have to do with me? This is theory. We're a couple of academics taking a walk. But imagine the visceral jolt, seeing your opponent bleeding in the dust. You think it adds to a person's store of credit, like a bank transaction? Nothingness is staring you in the face. Utter and permanent oblivion. You will cease to be. To be, Jack. The dyer accepts this and dies. The killer, in theory, attempts to defeat his own death by killing others. He buys time. He buys life. Watch others squirm. See the blood trickle in the dust. I looked at him, amazed. He drew contentedly on his pipe, making hollow sounds. It's a way of controlling death, a way of gaining the ultimate upper hand. Be the killer for a change. Let someone else be the dyer. Let him replace you theoretically in that role. You can't die if he does. He dies, you live. See how marvelously simple. You say this is what people have been doing for centuries. They're still doing it. They do it on a small, intimate scale. They do it in groups and crowds and masses. Kill to live. Sounds pretty awful. He seemed to shrug. Slaughter is never random. The more people you kill, the more power you gain over your own death. There is a secret precision at work in the most savage and indiscriminate killings. To speak about this is not to do public relations for murder. We are two academics in an intellectual environment. It's our duty to examine currents of thought, investigate the meaning of human behavior. But think how exciting! To come out a winner in a deathly struggle, to watch the bastard bleed. Plot a murder, you're saying. But every plot is a murder in effect. To plot is to die, whether we know it or not. To plot is to live, he said. I looked at him. I studied his face, his hands. We start our lives in chaos, in babel. As we surge up into the world, we try to devise a shape, a plan. There is dignity in this. Your whole life is a plot. A scheme, a diagram. It is a failed scheme, but that's not the point. To plot is to affirm life, to seek shape and control. Even after death, most particularly after death, the search continues. Burial rites are an attempt to complete the scheme in ritual. Picture a state funeral, Jack. It is all precision, detail, order, design. The nation holds its breath. The efforts of a huge and powerful government are brought to bear on a ceremony that will shed the last trace of chaos. If all goes well, if they bring it off, some natural law of perfection is obeyed. The nation is delivered from anxiety. The deceased's life is redeemed. Life itself is strengthened, reaffirmed.
Are you sure? I said.
To plot, to take aim at something, to shape time and space. This is how we advance the art of human consciousness. We moved in a wide arc back toward campus. Streets in deep and soundless shade. Garbage bags set out for collection. We crossed the sunset overpass, pausing briefly to watch the cars shoot by. Sunlight bouncing off the glass and chrome.
Are you a killer or a dyer, Jack?
You know the answer to that. I've been a dyer all my life.
What can you do about it?
What can any dyer do? Isn't it implicit in his makeup that he can't cross over?
Let's think about that. Let's examine the nature of the beast, so to speak. The male animal. Isn't there a fund, a pool, a reservoir of potential violence in the male psyche?
In theory, I suppose there is.
We're talking theory. That's exactly what we're talking. Two friends on a tree-shaded street. What else but theory? Isn't there a deep field? A sort of crude oil deposit that one might tap if and when the occasion warrants? A great, dark lake of male rage?
That's what Babette says. Homicidal rage. You sound like her.
Amazing lady. Is she right or wrong?
In theory, she's probably right.
Isn't there a sludgy region you'd rather not know about? A remnant of some prehistoric period when dinosaurs roamed the earth and men fought with flint tools? When to kill was to live?
Babette talks about male biology. Is it biology or geology?
Does it matter, Jack?
We only want to know whether it is there, buried in the most prudent and unassuming soul.
I suppose so. It can be. It depends.
Is it or isn't it there?
It's there, Murray. So what?
I only want to hear you say it. That's all. I only want to elicit truths you already possess, truths you've always known at some basic level.
Are you saying a dyer can become a killer?
I'm only a visiting lecturer. I theorize, I take walks, I admire the trees and houses. I have my students, my rented room, my TV set. I pick out a word here, an image there. I admire the lawns, the porches. What a wonderful thing a porch is! How did I live a life without a porch to sit on up till now? I speculate. I reflect. I take constant notes. I am here to think, to see. Let me warn you, Jack, I won't let up.
We passed my street and walked up the hill to the campus.
Who's your doctor?
Chakravarti, I said.
Is he good?
How would I know?
My shoulder separates, an old sexual injury.
I'm afraid to see him. I put the print out of my death in the bottom drawer of a dresser.
I know how you feel. But the tough part is yet to come. You've said goodbye to everyone but yourself. How does a person say goodbye to himself? It's a juicy, existential dilemma.
It certainly is. We walked past the administration building.
I hate to be the one who says it, Jack, but there's something that has to be said.
What?
Better you than me.
I nodded gravely.
Why does this have to be said?
Because friends have to be brutally honest with each other. I'd feel terrible if I didn't tell you what I was thinking, especially at a time like this.
I appreciate it, Murray. I really do. Besides, it's part of the universal experience of dying. Whether you think about it consciously or not, you're aware at some level that people are walking around saying to themselves, "Better him than me." It's only natural. You can't blame them or wish them ill.
Everyone but my wife. She wants to die first.
"Don't be so sure," he said.
We shook hands in front of the library. I thanked him for his honesty.
"That's what it all comes down to in the end," he said. "A person spends his life saying goodbye to other people.
How does he say goodbye to himself?"
I threw away picture frame wire, metal bookends, cork coasters, plastic key tags, dusty bottles of mercurochrome and Vaseline, crusted paintbrushes, caked shoe brushes, clotted correction fluid. I threw away candle stubs, laminated placemats, frayed potholders. I went after the padded clothes hangers, the magnetic memo clipboards. I was in a vengeful and near-savage state. I bore a personal grudge against these things. Somehow they'd put me in this fix. They'd dragged me down, made escape impossible. The two girls followed me around, observing a respectful silence. I threw away my battered khaki canteen, my ridiculous hip boots. I threw away diplomas, certificates, awards, and citations. When the girls stopped me, I was working the bathrooms, discarding used bars of soap, damp towels, shampoo bottles with streaked labels and missing caps.
"Please note, in several days, your new automated banking card will arrive in the mail. If it is a red card with a silver stripe, your secret code will be the same as it is now. If it is a green card with a gray stripe, you must appear at your branch, with your card, to devise a new secret code. Codes based on birthdays are popular. Warning: do not write down your code. Do not carry your code on your person. Remember, you cannot access your account unless your code is entered properly. Know your code. Reveal your code to no one. Only your code allows you to enter the system."
Chapter 38. My head was between her breasts, where it seemed to be spending a lot of time lately. She stroked my shoulder.
"Murray says the problem is that we don't repress our fear."
"Repress it?"
"Some people have the gift, some don't."
"The gift? I thought repression was outdated. They've been telling us for years not to repress our fears and desires. Repression causes tension, anxiety, unhappiness, 100 diseases and conditions. I thought the last thing we were supposed to do was repress something. They've been telling us to talk about our fears, get in touch with our feelings."
"Getting in touch with death is not what they had in mind. Death is so strong that we have to repress, those of us who know how."
"But repression is totally false and mechanical. Everybody knows that. We're not supposed to deny our nature."
"It's natural to deny our nature, according to Murray. It's the whole point of being different from animals."
"But that's crazy."
"It's the only way to survive," I said from her breasts. She stroked my shoulder, thinking about this. Gray flashes of a staticky man standing near a double bed. His body distorted, rippling, unfinished. I didn't have to imagine his motel companion. Our bodies were one surface, hers and mine, but the delectations of touch were preempted by Mr. Gray. It was his pleasure I experienced, his hold over Babette, his cheap and sleazy power. Down the hall, an eager voice said, "If you keep misplacing your ball of string, cage it in a Barney basket. Attach some organizer clips to your kitchen corkboard. Fasten the basket to the clips. Simple."
The next day I started carrying the Zumwalt automatic to school. It was in the flap pocket of my jacket when I lectured. It was in the top drawer of my desk when I received visitors in the office. The gun created a second reality for me to inhabit. The air was bright, swirling around my head. Nameless feelings pressed thrillingly on my chest. It was a reality I could control, secretly dominate. How stupid these people were, coming into my office unarmed. Late one afternoon, I took the gun out of my desk and examined it carefully. Only 3 bullets remained in the magazine. I wondered how Vernon Dickey had used the missing ammo, or whatever bullets are called by people familiar with firearms. 4 Dylar tablets, 3 Zumwalt bullets. Why was I surprised to find that the bullets were so unmistakably bullet-shaped? I guess I thought new names and shapes had been given to just about everything in the decades since I first became aware of objects and their functions. The weapon was gun-shaped, the little pointed projectiles reassuringly bullet-shaped. They were like childhood things you might come across after 40 years, seeing their genius for the first time. That evening I heard Heinrich in his room, moodily singing The Streets of Laredo. I stopped in to ask whether Orest had entered the cage yet. They said it was not humane. There was no place that would let him do it officially. He had to go underground.
Where is underground?
Watertown. Orest and his trainer. They found a public notary there who said he would certify a document that said that Orest Mercator spent so many days incarcerated with these venomous reptiles, blah, blah, blah.
Where would they find a large glass cage in Watertown?
They wouldn't.
Or what would they find?
A room in the only hotel, plus there were only 3 snakes. And he got bit in 4 minutes.
You mean the hotel let them place poisonous snakes in the room?
The hotel didn't know. The man who arranged the snakes carried them up in an airline bag. It was a whole massive deception, except the man showed up with 3 snakes instead of the agreed 27. In other words, he told them he had access to 27 snakes. Venomous. Except they weren't. So Orest got bit for nothing.
The jerk.
Suddenly he's a jerk. They had all this anti-venom, which they couldn't even use. The first 4 minutes.
How does he feel?
How would you feel if you were a jerk?
Glad to be alive, I said.
Not Orest. He dropped out of sight. He went into complete seclusion. Nobody's seen him since it happened. He doesn't answer the door. He doesn't answer the phone. He doesn't show up at school. The total package.
I decided to wander over to my office and glance at some final exams. Most of the students had already departed, eager to begin the routine hedonism of another bare-limbed summer. The campus was dark and empty. There was a trembling mist. Passing a line of trees, I thought I sensed someone edge in behind me, maybe 30 yards away. When I looked, the path was clear. Was it the gun that was making me jumpy? Does a gun draw violence to it, attract other guns to its surrounding field of force? I walked on quickly toward Centenary Hall. I heard footsteps on gravel, a conspicuous crunch. Someone was out there, on the edge of the parking area, in the trees and the mist. If I had a gun, why was I scared? If I was scared, why didn't I run? I counted off 5 paces, looked quickly left, saw a figure moving parallel to the path, in and out of deep shadow. I broke into a shambling trot, my gun hand in my pocket, clutching the automatic. When I looked again, he wasn't there. I slowed down warily, crossed a broad lawn, heard running, the meter of bounding feet. He was coming from the right this time, all out, closing fast. I broke into a weaving run, hoping I'd make an elusive target for someone firing at my back. I'd never run in a weave before. I kept my head down, swerved sharply and unpredictably. It was an interesting way to run. I was surprised at the range of possibilities, the number of combinations I could put together within a framework of left and right swerves. I did a tight left, widened it, cut sharply right, faked left, went wide right. About 20 yards from the end of the open area, I broke off the weave pattern and ran as fast and straight as I could for a red oak. I stuck out my left arm, went skidding around the tree in a headlong cranking countermotion, simultaneously using my right hand to pluck the zumwalt from my jacket pocket, so that I now faced the person I'd been fleeing, protected by a tree trunk, my gun at the ready. This was about as deft a thing as I'd ever done. I looked into the heavy mist as my attacker approached in little thudding footfalls. When I saw the familiar, odd, loping stride, I put the gun back in my pocket. It was Winnie Richards, of course. "Hi, Jack. At first I didn't know who it was, so I used evasive tactics. When I realized it was you, I said to myself, 'That's just the person I want to see.'
How come?
Remember that time you asked me about a secret research group? Working on fear of death? Trying to perfect a medication?
Sure. Dilar.
There was a journal lying around the office yesterday. American Psychobiologist. Curious story in there. Such a group definitely existed. Supported by a multinational giant. Operating in the deepest secrecy in an unmarked building just outside Iron City.
Why deepest secrecy?
It's obvious. To prevent espionage by competitive giants. The point is, they came very close to achieving their objective.
What happened?
A lot of things. The resident organizational genius, one of the forces behind the whole project, was a fellow named Willie Mink. He turns out to be a controversial fellow. He does some very, very controversial things.
I'll bet I know the first thing he does. He runs an ad in a gossip tabloid asking for volunteers for a hazardous experiment. Fear of death, it says.
Very good, Jack. A little ad in some rinky-dink newspaper. He interviews the respondents in a motel room, testing them for emotional integration and about a dozen other things in an attempt to work up a death profile for each person. Interviews in a motel. When the scientists and the lawyers find out about this, they go slightly berserk. They reprimand Mink. They put all their resources into computer testing. Berserk official reaction.
But that's not the end of it.
How right you are. Despite the fact that Mink is now a carefully observed person, one of the volunteers manages to slip through the screen of watchfulness and begins a program of more or less unsupervised human experimentation, using a drug that is totally unknown, untested, and unapproved, with side effects that could beach a whale. An unsupervised, well-built human.
Female, I said.
Very correct. She periodically reports to Mink in the very motel where he originally did his interviewing, sometimes arriving in a taxi, sometimes on foot from the shabby and depressing bus terminal. What is she wearing, Jack?
I don't know.
A ski mask. She is the woman in the ski mask. When the others find out about Mink's latest caper, there is a period of prolonged controversy, animosity, litigation, and disgrace. Pharmaceutical giants have their code of ethics, just like you and me. The project manager is kicked out. The project goes on without him.
Did the article say what happened to him?
The reporter tracked him down. He is living in the same motel where all the controversy took place.
Where is the motel? in Germantown.
Where's that? I said.
Iron City. It's the old German section, behind the foundry.
I didn't know there was a section in Iron City called Germantown.
The Germans are gone, of course.
I went straight home. Denise was making check marks in a paperback book called Directory of Toll-Free Numbers. I found Babette sitting by Wilder's bed reading him a story. I don't mind running clothes as such, I said. A sweatsuit is a practical thing to wear at times. But I wish you wouldn't wear it when you read bedtime stories to Wilder or braid Steffi's hair. There's something touching about such moments that is jeopardized by running clothes.
Maybe I'm wearing running clothes for a reason.
Like what?
I'm going running, she said.
Is that a good idea? At night?
What is night?
It happens 7 times a week. Where is the uniqueness in this?
It's dark. It's wet. Do we live in a blinding desert glare?
What is wet?
We live with wet.
Babette doesn't speak like this.
Does life have to stop because our half of the earth is dark? Is there something about the night that physically resists a runner? I need to pant and gasp. What is dark? It's just another name for light.
No one will convince me that the person I know as Babette actually wants to run up the stadium steps at 10 o'clock at night.
It's not what I want, it's what I need. My life is no longer in the realm of want. I do what I have to do. I pant, I gasp. Every runner understands the need for this.
Why do you have to run up steps? You're not a professional athlete trying to rebuild a shattered knee. Run on plain land. Don't make a major involvement out of it. Everything is a major involvement today.
It's my life. I tend to be involved.
It's not your life. It's only exercise.
A runner needs, she said.
I also need, and tonight I need the car. Don't wait up for me. Who knows when I'll be back? I waited for her to ask what mysterious mission would require me to get in the car and drive through the rain-streaked night, time of return unknown. She said, "I can't walk to the stadium, run up the steps 5 or 6 times, and then walk all the way back home. You can drive me there, wait for me, drive me back. The car is then yours."
"I don't want it." "What do you think of that? You want the car, you take it. The streets are slippery. You know what that means, don't you?"
"What does it mean?"
"Fasten your seat belt. There's also a chill in the air. You know what a chill in the air means."
"What does it mean?"
"Wear your ski mask," I told her. The thermostat began to buzz. I put on a jacket and went outside. Ever since the airborne toxic event, our neighbors, the Stovers, had been keeping their car in the driveway instead of the garage, keeping it facing the street, keeping the key in the ignition. I walked up the driveway and got in the car. There were trash caddies fixed to the dashboard and seat backs, dangling plastic bags full of gum wrappers, ticket stubs, lipstick-smeared tissues, crumpled soda cans, crumpled circulars and receipts, ashtray debris, popsicle sticks and French fries, crumpled coupons and paper napkins, pocket combs with missing teeth. Thus familiarized, I started up the engine, turned on the lights, and drove off. I ran a red light when I crossed Middlebrook. Reaching the end of the expressway ramp, I did not yield. All the way to Iron City. I felt a sense of dreaminess, release, unreality. I slowed down at the toll gate, but did not bother tossing a quarter into the basket. An alarm went off, but no one pursued. What's another quarter to a state that is billions in debt? What's 25 cents when we are talking about a $9,000 stolen car?
This must be how people escape the pull of the earth, the gravitational leaf flutter that brings us hourly closer to dying. Simply stop obeying. Steal instead of buy. Shoot instead of talk. I ran two more lights on the rainy approach roads to Iron City. The outlying buildings were long and low, fish and produce markets, meat terminals with old wooden canopies. I entered the city and turned on the radio, needing company not on the lonely highway, but here on the cobbled streets, in the sodium vapor lights, where the emptiness clings. Every city has its districts. I drove past the abandoned car district, the uncollected garbage district, the sniper fire district, the districts of smoldering sofas and broken glass. Ground glass crunched under the tires. I headed toward the foundry. Random access memory, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, mutual assured destruction. I still felt extraordinarily light, lighter than air, colorless, odorless, invisible. But around the lightness and dreaminess, something else was building, an emotion of a different order, a surge, a will, an agitation of the passions. I reached into my pocket, rubbed my knuckles across the grainy, stainless steel of the Zumwalt barrel. The man on the radio said, "Void where prohibited." Chapter 39. I drove twice around the foundry, looking for signs of some erstwhile German presence. I drove past the row houses. They were set on a steep hill, narrow-fronted frame houses, a climbing line of pitched roofs. I drove past the bus terminal, through the beating rain. It took a while to find the motel, a one-story building set against the concrete pier of an elevated roadway. It was called the Roadway Motel. Transient pleasures, drastic measures. The area was deserted, a spray-painted district of warehouses and light industry. The motel had 9 or 10 rooms, all dark, no cars out front. I drove past 3 times, studying the scene, and parked half a block away, in the rubble under the roadway. Then I walked back to the motel. Those were the first 3 elements in my plan. Here is my plan. Drive past the scene several times. Park some distance from the scene. Go back on foot. Locate Mr. Gray under his real name or an alias. Shoot him 3 times in the viscera for maximum pain. Clear the weapon of prints. Place the weapon in the victim's staticky hand. Find a crayon or lipstick tube and scrawl a cryptic suicide note on the full-length mirror. Take the victim's supply of Dilar tablets. Slip back to the car. Proceed to the expressway entrance. Head east toward Blacksmith. Get off at the old river road. Park Stover's car in Old Man Treadwell's garage. Shut the garage door. Walk home in the rain and the fog. Elegant. My airy mood returned. I was advancing in consciousness. I watched myself take each separate step. With each separate step, I became aware of processes, components, things relating to other things. Water fell to earth in drops. I saw things new. There was an aluminum awning over the office door. On the door itself were little plastic letters arranged in slots to spell out a message. The message was, "Numish Boot Zupko." Gibberish, but high-quality gibberish. I made my way along the wall, looking through the windows. My plan was this. Stand at the edges of windows with my back to the wall, swivel my head to look peripherally into rooms. Some windows were bare.
Some had blinds or dusty shades. I could make out the rough outlines of chairs or beds in the dark rooms. Trucks rumbled overhead. In the next-to-last unit, there was the scantest flicker of light. I stood at the edge of the window, listening. I swiveled my head, looked into the room out of the corner of my right eye. A figure sat in a low armchair, looking up at the flickering light. I sensed I was part of a network of structures and channels. I knew the precise nature of events. I was moving closer to things in their actual state as I approached a violence, a smashing intensity. Water fell in drops. Surfaces gleamed. It occurred to me that I did not have to knock. The door would be open. I gripped the knob, eased the door open, slipped into the room. Stealth. It was easy. Everything would be easy. I stood inside the room, sensing things, noting the room tone, the dense air. Information rushed toward me, rushed slowly, incrementally. The figure was male, of course, and sat sprawled in the short-legged chair. He wore a Hawaiian shirt and Budweiser shorts. Plastic sandals dangled from his feet. The dumpy chair, the rumpled bed, the industrial carpet, the shabby dresser, the sad green walls and ceiling cracks. The TV floating in the air, in a metal brace, pointing down at him. He spoke first, without taking his eyes from the flickering screen.
"Are you heart sick or soul sick?"
I stood against the door.
"You're Mink," I said.
In time he looked at me, looked at the large, friendly figure with the slumped shoulders and forgettable face.
"What kind of name is Willie Mink?" I said.
"It's a first and last name. Same as anybody."
Did he speak with an accent? His face was odd, concave, forehead and chin jutting. He was watching TV without the sound.
"Some of these sure-footed bighorns have been equipped with radio transmitters," he said.
I could feel the pressure and density of things. So much was happening. I sensed molecules active in my brain moving along neural pathways.
"You're here for some Dylar, of course?"
"Of course. What else?"
"What else?"
"Rid the fear."
"Rid the fear. Clear the grid."
"Clear the grid. That's why they come to me."
This was my plan. Enter unannounced, gain his confidence, wait for an unguarded moment, take out the Zumwalt, shoot him 3 times in the viscera for maximum slowness of agony, put the gun in his hand to suggest a lonely man's suicide, write semi-coherent things on the mirror, leave Stover's car in Treadwell's garage.
"By coming in here, you agree to a certain behavior," Mink said.
"What behavior?"
"Room behavior. The point of rooms is that they're inside. No one should go into a room unless he understands this. People behave one way in rooms, another way in streets, parks, and airports. To enter a room is to agree to a certain kind of behavior. It follows that this would be the kind of behavior that takes place in rooms. This is the standard as opposed to parking lots and beaches. It is the point of rooms. No one should enter a room not knowing the point. There is an unwritten agreement between the person who enters a room and the person whose room has been entered, as opposed to open-air theaters, outdoor pools. The purpose of a room derives from the special nature of a room. A room is inside. This is what people in rooms have to agree on, as differentiated from lawns, meadows, fields, orchards.
I agreed completely. It made perfect sense. What was I here for, if not to define, fix in my sights, take aim at? I heard a noise, faint, monotonous,